Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Thursday, May 18th, 2017.
I've always been proud to say that I work for the Department of Justice because of that for which it stands, which is an unyielding commitment to the rule of law and to the safety and security of the citizens we serve.
I think it's a very positive step that a special counsel has been appointed.
So Bob Mueller will take over the FBI investigation.
Yes. You want to make sure that you have somebody who doesn't have to reinvent the wheel.
As a special counsel, Robert Mueller has the same authority as a U.S. attorney.
How will the appointment of former FBI Director Robert Mueller affect the other investigations that are ongoing?
Director of the FBI, I think, is well thought of by people on both sides of the aisle.
This will restore the American people's trust in institutions.
He's as good as it gets. I mean, his credentials are impeccable.
Robert Mueller is solid ground.
More amazed Washington voices reacting to what's been going on in the nation's capital. In the garden provided by Soundgarden, we're noting the passing at age 52 of Chris Cornell. You'll hear more of that music all this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Former FBI Director Robert Mueller has now been appointed by the Department of Justice as special counsel to lead the investigation into Russian interference in the election. Former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and campaign chairman Paul Manafort, among many others, are being investigated. This was a Justice Department call made solely by Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general. It came as much of a surprise to the White House as James Comey's firing at the FBI came to him. Reports say the White House had about 30 minutes notice. As Mueller settles into his job, the chair of which might be something you would pay to ride at a Six Flags amusement park, it was revealed that weeks before the inauguration, Mike Flynn, former national security advisor and someone now very much at the center of this investigation in every way, notified President Trump's transition team that the FBI knew about and was investigating him for being a paid lobbyist for Turkey during the campaign. Nevertheless, Flynn still got the job. 24 days later, he was fired. President Trump's characterization of all this on Twitter, the latest Twitter anyway, the greatest witch hunt of a politician in American history. Well, if that's the case, the hunter has a lot of experience then. Robert Mueller preceded James Comey as the FBI director, serving from 01 to 2013 under both the Bush and Obama administrations, longest serving director since J. Edgar Hoover. Robert Ray, former federal prosecutor and independent counsel for the Whitewater investigation, currently partner at Thompson and Knight, helps us out here. Robert Ray, thanks for joining us again today.
So soon.
So soon, indeed.
Great to be back.
Who is Mr. Mueller in this particular case, and who was it who authorized his investigation and authority right now?
Well, ordinarily, the authority would come from the Attorney General. In this instance, the Attorney General recused himself. The task then falls to the Deputy Attorney General. There's no question that the special counsel is an executive branch appointee
right. First.
So ultimately, that person reports, I suppose, in a technical sense, to the president, who is the executive authority. But the regulations are designed to provide insulation. I mean, ultimately, the appointee is answerable to the deputy attorney general, but obviously with an enormous amount of freedom and independence.
But he can still be fired by the president.
Yeah, and he could be fired by the deputy attorney general, yes. Now, understand also, remember, a special counsel has a specific task that that individual is charged to undertake, and that is to decide whether or not crimes have been committed. That's the job of a prosecutor. Now, Bob Mueller has served as the FBI director, but in this task, he's a prosecutor. And his task, again, is not to be a fact gatherer, but only to gather evidence necessary to decide whether any crimes have been committed. As far as the public's right to know in public session, that's a task more suited, at least in the first instance, to Congress. And so those two tasks, at least theoretically, can go on simultaneously. Congress can investigate through its investigatory authority, through a select committee or through the existing intelligence committee, you know, whatever it may be, in order so that the public is assured, you know, what the facts are and where they lead and so on and so forth. Now, there are instances where there's a bit of overlap, and that creates and has created in the past some problems. In other words, to the extent that Congress treads over ground that Mr. Mueller may want to, you know, exercise in terms of deciding whether or not prosecutions should be brought, Congress will be reluctant to interfere with that, you know, the prerogative of the special counsel to decide whether or not a criminal prosecution is warranted.
That's the case where congressional testimony might interfere or congressional immunity might interfere with the prosecution later on of someone in a criminal matter.
And I suspect we're going to face that even in the, you know, in the immediate future. Congress may well have an interest in having the former FBI director, Jim Comey, testify. If he testifies publicly, I mean, that's testimony under oath. It's public. That may be seen in, you know, by Mr. Mueller, at least at this early stage, as being in some way potentially jeopardizing what it is he would, you know, be prepared to do with regard to the criminal investigation. So there'll be some tug and pull there. But, I mean, all of this is new territory. I mean, understand that Mr. Mueller's appointment under the special counsel regulations, that's a first. That's never happened before. The only other precedent for this was when then Deputy Attorney General Jim Comey appointed Patrick Fitzgerald. But Patrick Fitzgerald was at the time a sitting United States attorney in the Northern District of Illinois in Chicago. So that wasn't an appointment actually by invoking these special counsel regulations. This is the first time they've been used. So we're in new territory here.
And Mueller, of course, understands he's in new territory.
Of course.
Does that make his job easier or harder?
Well, I think the most difficult job of a special counsel, independent counsel, special prosecutor is the ramp-up time necessary to get your office fully in place. The fact that he's been an FBI director and a U.S. attorney and has served in the highest levels of the Justice Department means that I think his ramp-up time will be considerably shorter than otherwise would be the case. So I expect he'll get to the task rather quickly, and he'll take over the existing investigation, as I understand it, being directed out of the Eastern District of Virginia in Alexandria.
Can he investigate anything?
Not anything, but his charter is fairly wide. It, you know, obviously it is the on both sides of the Russia probe, which would mean both, you know, investigating the current administration as well as investigating the Russians, and anything that, you know, he feels is appropriate within that broad charter. To the extent that he needs additional authority, he is certainly permitted to, and the regulations contemplate that he would go back to Rod Rosenstein mm-hmm. for an expansion of authority if necessary.
Finally, we've got this curious case of Mr. Rosenstein, who it looks to me as though is the equivalent of someone on a subway car pulling the cord and putting the brakes on everything. This was his call.
Yes.
That's
a big decision.
That's a big one.
Especially when you've only been on the job for, what is it, 3 weeks?
I mean, that's all by itself. That's astounding to contemplate.
Well, someone asked me, you know, if you had to give advice to a special counsel, what advice would you give? And I remember when I was appointed independent counsel, the first thing that I read was Leon Jaworski's The Right and the Power. I went back over the last few days just to review the conclusion of that book. And it really had, in my view, then and now, two takeaways. The first is the obvious, but it's important to remind ourselves of this, and that is while the system isn't perfect, the system does ultimately work, meaning, you know, American constitutional government. And the second takeaway, of course, was the principle that was vindicated then, I hope was vindicated by my investigation, and I'm sure will be vindicated in this investigation, among other things, and that is that no person, including the president, is above the law.
Robert Reyes, former federal prosecutor and independent counsel for the Whitewater investigation during the Clinton years. He's currently partner at Thompson and Knight. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn only gets deeper and deeper into all this as Mueller comes on board. Besides the allegations about Russia, Flynn's relationship to Turkey, a relationship we learn is worth more than $500,000, reports say that may have led directly to a decision Flynn made as incoming National Security Advisor relating to the fight against the Islamic State during the mere 24 days he had that job. Karen Tumulty is a national political correspondent for The Washington Post. She says everything is up in the air as Mueller takes over.
What is known is that it was known that he had alerted the Trump team, the transition team, the key decision makers that he had this conflict and that the decision was made to hire him anyway. It once again kind of speaks to how with Donald Trump, loyalty seems to sort of trump everything.
Well, it raises questions about Mike Pence, who, you know, weeks ago was this poor victim of Mr. Flynn didn't tell him the whole truth, and this vice president who is above reproach is suddenly, angered at Mike Flynn, and that's why he resigns. That whole story seems to be hogwash.
There are so many things that we have discovered just within the last 8 days that would raise questions about Mike Pence, the vice president, including the fact that in mid-February, the day after Flynn is fired, there was a meeting at the White House with James Comey. And at that point, President Trump asks both Mike Pence and the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, to leave the room so that he can have a private word with the FBI director. The fact that this was really a bad thing to do, you know, that somebody in this room should have exercised a little bit of common sense, that the president should not be having these private conversations with the FBI director at this moment, should have occurred to everyone, and especially Mike Pence, who his reputation is, you know, he's often the grown-up in the room. He is the old Washington hand. He's the guy, the stickler to procedure. He and Sessions should not have left that room.
It appears to be clear that people knew that Flynn was being investigated for Turkey, that he disclosed that he was being investigated for his relationship with Turkey. It didn't seem to be any kind of an issue for the Trump administration.
The fact that this information is coming out, this is information that could ultimately prove to be legal protection for General Flynn, suggests that there may be more in this pipeline.
More in what sense?
In the sense that either he or people around him have decided, we already saw him make an effort to get immunity, which doesn't appear to be going anywhere. So in this case, I don't know their sourcing, but it's not out of the realm of possibility that this is an effort to sort of immunize himself through the media. The scrutiny is definitely headed towards 1600 Pennsylvania
right.
Avenue here.
I mean, it's a very short list. I mean, it's Pence, it's Reince Priebus, it's Donald Trump, and maybe one or two others.
And probably, you know, whoever was in the room urging that Flynn be hired despite these obvious problems, perceived or actual.
Karen Tumulty, keep up the good work. Thanks so much. It's great to talk to you again.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering tech products, solutions, and services for business like PC setup and repair, data recovery, and virus protection. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, it's pro time. And Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at lumosity.com.
Called the Justice Department to look into the leaks. Those are criminal leaks.
Papers are being leaked. Things are being leaked. It's criminal action, criminal act.
The leaks are absolutely real. The news is fake. Those are criminal leaks.
President Trump puts this all down to leaks and witch hunts. It's a venerable history there, this tension between the White House and the leaker community. We've heard everything from reports of the president watching television alone in his bathrobe, agitated phone conversations with world leaders, all the way to the existence of a memo written by fired FBI Director James Comey describing the president's request that FBI Director Comey let the Russian investigation go. Paul Rosenzweig, attorney, Homeland Security consultant, formerly a Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy in the Department of Homeland Security and co-editor of Whistleblowers, Leaks, and the Media, the First Amendment and National Security. Mr. Rosenzweig says there is a taxonomy, a food chain, if you will, of leaks and leakers.
Well, the basic taxonomy is divided between those who stay within the confines of legally authorized means of disclosures, those are whistleblowers, and those who go outside of those bounds and leak. And within the leak community, there are kind of two subsets. There's leaks to the media, which, though they're outside the bounds of lawful disclosure from the government's perspective, have a sense of justice and righteousness to them, at least in terms of the people who make the leaks themselves. And then the last category is leaks to adversaries and foreign powers, spies.
Right, exactly.
And we think that they're treasonous.
Does the president have a good understanding of what leaks are sort of part of the functioning of government and what leaks are nefarious and should be gone after, and what leaks are actually criminal?
Our president?
Yes.
I think it would be actually fair to say that all presidents seem to characterize leaks that disadvantage them as nefarious and leaks that advance their interests as for the good of the country. You know, President Obama, for example, his administration brought more leak prosecutions against people that others would characterize as whistleblowers than all the other administrations combined before it, going back to George Washington's time. So even though we have a sense of President Obama as a liberal, small L or big L president, his administration had a curiously anti-free press leak patina to it. President Trump likewise seems to think that leaks from inside his White House that disadvantage him are ones that ought to be prosecuted, and has been quoted as urging the FBI director to go after the press in prosecuting such leaks. So I tend to think that presidential characterizations of leaks are politicized by where they sit a fair amount.
We've had the referencing in the current administration's anxiety over leaking of actual jailing reporters, going after reporters and jailing them for one reason or another. You then also mentioned, and I should point this out, that the Obama administration went after leakers more than anyone else in the history of the United States. Would you say that a chilling effect on journalists who fear imprisonment or various kinds of trouble has actually been effectively put upon the press, given the behavior of the Obama administration and now the, shall we say, real anxiety of the Trump administration?
Well, I certainly couldn't speak for every member of the press, but certainly there have been anecdotal reports of pressmen who've left difficult beats like the national security beat to go cover easy things like urban health or something like that. The truth of the matter is, first, you know, we've never put a pressman in jail for receiving classified information, for being the recipient of a leak. The only time press people have gone to jail has been for protecting their sources, that is, honoring promises of confidentiality that don't have a strong moral force but aren't fully supported in the law. There has seemed to be an uptick of that latter case lately. And what I counsel journalists who ask me is, you know what you're going to decide in the end before you make the promise. There probably was an era of easy confidentiality, and now it means a lot more. So I think that the bottom line answer is that President Trump's threat to jail press for reporting leaks would be extremely novel, and probably we shouldn't take too much concern of it unless and until he actually implements it. And I suspect there'd be a lot of institutional barriers to implementation, not the least of which is that the courts would probably throw out such indictments on First Amendment grounds.
Finally, for the American people who might be weary of all this discussion of leaking and people attempting to bring down the government and people going after the president because they believe the election is illegitimate, illegal in some way, for policy reasons, to protect themselves, all the possible reasons for leaking. What would you advise the American people trying to make sense of all this regarding leaking?
Well, I mean, all of those are true. Every last one of those is a possible method or means or motive for leaking. But there's also the leaks that are intended to disclose misconduct and malfeasance by our government. The classic case of the Pentagon Papers leaps immediately to mind. I would say that it is incumbent upon every citizen who's a consumer of leaks, whether through the press or through their tweet stream, to look at them with a not a critical eye, but with an eye of assessment. What are the motives of the alleged source? And how does that square with the veracity of what he's saying? Is there corroboration elsewhere, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? We make judgments like that about the truth telling of our friends and family and business acquaintances every day. And leakers are no different. They're some lie, some are telling us the horrific truth, and it's up to us to figure it out.
Common sense is a good guide here. That's good advice. Paul Rosenzweig is an attorney, Homeland Security and consultant, and formerly a deputy assistant secretary for policy in the Department of Homeland Security. Paul, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Ann calling from Portland, Oregon. If the act of leaking ultimately leads to a more secure union, I'm all in favor of it. Without leaks, the American people would never have a clue about corruption in the ranks of government.
What's your view on leaking? Do you support it? Does it help the government? Does it hurt? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Join the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom.com, helping small business owners get started with incorporation, LLCs, DBAs, and nonprofits, while providing ongoing legal advice through its network of independent attorneys. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and Roger Ailes is no more. From his steep fall and departure from Fox News due to allegations of persistent sexual misconduct, Ailes died suddenly at age 77. He leaves behind Fox News, one of the most watched and influential cable news networks in history. In some time slots, Fox's audience numbers were untouchable. Ailes created the opinionated modern news network with a fusion of campaign attacks, a columnist's opinions, and a paranoia about liberal invaders. Kerwin Swint is chair of the Department of Political Science and International Affairs at Kennesaw State University and author of Dark Genius, the influential career of legendary political operative and Fox News founder Roger Ailes. Swint says all that influence began when Ailes stepped from entertainment to politics.
When Nixon met Roger Ailes, that was a marriage made in heaven. Ailes was such a master at communicating ideas and symbols, first with Nixon, and then he turned it into a very successful political consulting career, then to broadcasting. And he took the sort of same America first, nationalistic, very conservative, patriotic viewpoint to Fox News. And that was in the Fox News DNA, just as it was in the Nixon campaign.
The talent that he picked, I mean, with some exceptions, was very well thought out and often seemed, oh, that'll never work. And then, boom, it became the most successful thing. Give me some examples.
I really think he understood TV better than anybody, maybe ever, as far as what kind of personality, like a Sean Hannity or a Bill O'Reilly or even a Megyn Kelly, would really connect with the viewers. He got that from political campaign communication. He got a lot of it from talk radio. Fox News brought a lot of talk radio dynamics into cable news. And so, yeah, he really knew how to match up personalities with style in a way that connects.
Is Roger Ailes' legacy that there is no more journalism anymore? There's only advocacy journalism, whether you're Rachel Maddow or Sean Hannity?
Well, I think that's part of his legacy. I mean, he's going to be known, for one thing, for creativity and a take-no-prisoners mentality. But certainly Fox News is going to be remembered as the first major news organization that had an ideological point of view built from the ground up. And I think that did change news broadcasting in the 90s and later.
It was clear that Fox gave Roger Ailes complete autonomy over there at Fox News until the very end.
Well, he sure did. I mean, when Rupert Murdoch talked to Roger Ailes about what a news broadcast would look like that could compete with CNN, they knew that they had a niche there. They knew the conservatives were out there looking for an alternative. They didn't like the liberal mass media. And so there was a natural market for it. And Ailes really is a political consultant more than anything. I mean, the beating heart of Roger Ailes was always politics, Republican politics. And so he ran this news organization, Fox News, much like one would run a political campaign, attack style, bottom line reporting, you know, really emphasizing messages that motivated the base. So, you know, that's what made him different and made Fox News different. It was really a political type operation.
After Roger Ailes, are Americans more or less able to be informed voters capable of participating in a healthy democracy?
Well, I mean, you can't deny he gave a big part of the market something that they hadn't had before, a more conservative news outlook in the information flow. So from that standpoint, he gave a lot of Americans a news broadcast they could respond to and believe. But at the same time, studies show a lot of Fox News viewers have a very limited understanding of news and information. So, you know, I hate to hedge, but I mean, he gave some people what they wanted. But, you know, that news product is different from most of the rest.
Kerwin Swint is chair of the Department of Political Science and International Affairs at Kennesaw State University, author of Dark Genius, The Influential Career of Legendary Political Operative and Fox News Founder Roger Ailes. Kerwin Swint, thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. While Washington boils in its own headlines in an unseasonable heat wave, we return to our look at a growing national crisis. In the 100 days since President Trump signed an executive order outlining immigration enforcement, federal agents have arrested 41,318 people on immigration charges. It's a 38% increase from the same period last year, broadening the targets for immigration violations. Unclear how many of those 41,000 or so have already been deported, but on their way out of the country, most, if not all, would have had to spend some time in immigration detention. On Wednesday, Ultukumar Patel died in custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the eighth death this year and the second in this week alone. Patel was being held in the Atlanta City Detention Center. In California, the Adelanto Detention Center, which is run by the private prison company The Geo Group, had two deaths in March and April of this year alone. Robin Yurevich is a contributor to the publication Capital and Maine, and she visited Adelanto to investigate the case of Norma Gutierrez, a detainee whose health has been seriously compromised during her stay.
Norma Gutierrez is a 41-year-old woman, and she was in detention about 5 or 6 months by the time I saw her. In late January, she suffered what seemed to be a stroke-like episode. She lost consciousness. She fell down on the floor of her dorm room. The right side of her body was paralyzed. She couldn't move her eyes. She couldn't move her mouth. She was taken to a hospital in San Bernardino, where she said that, you know, she was treated unlike any way she had ever been treated at a hospital in the past. They said she was fine and sent her back to the facility. About 16 hours later, she suffered the same type of episode. But instead of taking her to a hospital, she was taken in handcuffs to a cold room in the facility, as she described it. She was left there for 4 days, and she said she was visited by a nurse who gave her the medications that she had been previously prescribed, but didn't offer her any medical care. After she got out of there, she had a third episode. And after this third episode, she said, I'm going to seek medical care when I get out of this place. She no longer wanted the facility to treat her in any way. So she's pretty afraid for her health.
What are the rules for health care at immigration detention centers run by private sector companies?
Well, there are rules and standards, and they apply to private sector companies just like they apply when ICE provides its own health care. In this facility, they say that they provide 24-hour care. Detainees who want to be seen ask to see a nurse, and by some accounts, you know, they get to see them quickly. By other accounts, there are tremendous delays. When we were on a tour of this detention facility, we saw really nice, clean facilities. But ICE's record of providing health care in detention is pretty poor. There's a Human Rights Watch report that's out as of May 8th. They studied 18 deaths in detention and found out that poor care contributed to the deaths in 7 of those cases.
Are these parallel prisons, or are they a fundamentally unregulated zone where for-profit companies basically operate a kind of, Guantanamo Bay, where people are held indefinitely and the oversight is limited at best?
Well, oversight is limited, but ICE would never say that there was no oversight. They say that they're inspected several times a year. And there is something called the Office of Detention Oversight within ICE. But I would say that another issue is transparency. For example, there was a death at Adelanto in 2015 of a man that had cancer. And he complained of gastrointestinal symptoms for 2 years and never got any attention. And when Human Rights Watch examined his case, they noted that obviously had he gotten care earlier, he might have survived.
Does that result in any penalties for the facility?
No, it has not. It hasn't.
Robin Yurovich is a contributor for the publication Capital and Maine in Los Angeles. Robin, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering tech products, solutions, and services for business like PC setup and repair, data recovery, and virus protection. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, it's pro time.
Austin, Texas is one of the fastest growing communities in the United States. It's also a national cultural center, the home of the South by Southwest Conference. It's more than a conference. You can hear the most contemporary music along with lectures on the sustainability of climate and urban culture. But Austin isn't just listening. It's doing things to confront climate change. 2016 was the warmest year on record since modern record keeping began in 1880. In Austin, KUT reporter Mose Bushell says this city of bike paths and Formula One racers is looking for ways to cool things down.
When you think of Austin, you probably think about what? Music? Breakfast tacos? Maybe the state capital? What about the heat?
It's too darn hot.
After all, it is Texas, so Austin gets really, really hot.
I can't go outside without, I hive up. I have an allergy to the sun, so I'm particularly sensitive to it.
That's Leah Haney, and her aversion to the sun is unfortunate because of what she does for work. She's an environmental program coordinator with the city of Austin.
You really are allergic to the sun?
I really am. It's really embarrassing. But I love Austin, so I stay.
Some years, the heat is worse than others. But on average, Haney says, climate change means it's going to get worse, and our cities may not be prepared.
Cities are just natural heat pockets. We're heat sinks, you know? And it's really not conducive to the human condition.
She says cities can be around 5 degrees hotter in the day and over 20 degrees hotter at night than surrounding countryside.
It's something special that happens in an urban environment when you have a lot of built man-made materials.
This is called the heat island effect. And Austin is trying to dig its way out.
What we're looking at right now is a tree planting that's about to start.
Emily King is with the city's urban forestry department. On a recent spring day, she watched volunteers unload shovels and start digging holes next to a community college parking lot. She says every year, the city distributes 4,200 trees to residents for the specific purpose of combating urban heat.
And when trees have enough room to grow and they're healthy, they do this amazing thing where they actually cause the air around them to be cooler through a process called evapotranspiration.
This is separate from the benefits of shade, and it can drop the temperature around a tree by up to 9 degrees. In Austin, they even use satellite images to look for bald spots in the urban canopy where more trees can go.
The whole impetus behind this program and this funding is just that, to help cool Austin, to help shade it and help cool it.
And Austin's not the only place giving it a shot.
At the moment, I'm looking out a window at some beautiful trees. It's always a nice reminder that there's more to life than sitting at your desk, isn't it?
This is Kathy Oak. She's a city council member in Melbourne, Australia. Melbourne's taken the battle against heat farther than almost any other city.
the research shows for every 10 to 15% increased canopy cover, you can reduce the urban temperature by up to 5 degrees Celsius.
That's 9 degrees Fahrenheit.
So we have a target to double our canopy cover.
But there's a problem in Melbourne and in Austin. Year by year, trees are dying faster than they can be replaced. Some of it's because of construction, some of it's because of old age, and some of it's drought. And in some cases, it's because new invasive trees are taking over native species.
You should have waited for a weed wrench to pull that up. See that root system?
I'm walking through a park with volunteer Cliff Tillich as he removes invasive ligustrum trees and replaces them with native saplings. The thing is, it's hard to tell the difference.
This one? That's one of the saplings we planted.
Oh my gosh, I just pulled up a
native plant.
But
Can you put it back in?
Yes, I can put it back in.
Cliff is no fan of invasives, but they are resilient. That's why they're invasive. There are places in this forest where they survived a devastating drought that killed thousands of local trees. And he leads me to one of them.
The tree we see leaning there is a pecan. It did die in the drought. Ligustrums all around it. And that looks to me like it was the escarpment black cherry that was standing in this area and died in the drought, with the ligustrums around it doing just fine.
Again, it's just a real illustration of how these trees that have evolved to survive this harsh weather, they fell victim to the drought, but some of the invasives actually made it.
Yeah.
It also demands a question. If the city is planting trees to prepare for Austin's hotter future, should some of these exotic species, the very plants that seem so resilient in the dryness and heat, be included in that plan?
That is a loaded question in tree circles, actually.
Again, City of Austin's Emily King.
Depending on who you ask, you're going to get a different answer to what should we be doing with this.
Ask Kathy Oak down in Melbourne. She says the city is planting a mix of native and exotic species. Ask Meg Inglis, you get a different answer.
Me, I would hedge my bets with natives.
Inglis is with the Texas Native Plant Society. She says a lot of introduced species are just too destructive. They starve out local wildlife, suck up too much water, generally turn ecosystems on their heads.
If the ecosystem collapses, then we lose our services, the ecosystem services that are provided to us, like sequestering of carbon, providing oxygen, putting more water into the aquifer.
But what if the ecosystem is already changing? Since we don't know exactly how hot, dry, or flood-prone climate change will make us, does it make sense to hedge our bets by bringing in some outside trees? Emily King with the City of Austin says that's what the city does.
I don't think that we can be overly picky with where exactly something originated if our end goal is to really make sure that Austin remains livable. And to be livable, we do need to try to reduce the heat that we're experiencing.
A lot of this is just a question of how you define native. Is it a plant from a bit south of here that's now spreading in? An introduced tree that's been here for centuries? As for Cliff Tillich, the guy in the park, he prefers natives, but he says within that range you can find a lot of things to plant.
A nice thing about this particular replanting program is that they're planting lots of different species, and the ones that do well in the conditions we wind up having over the next 5, 10, 15 years are the ones that will thrive.
It's like a laboratory.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So should we walk and see more of it?
Yeah, let's do it. He also says he knows the land he's working will never return to the way it was 100 years ago, before people moved in and things started getting hotter. For The Takeaway, I'm Mose Bouchel in Austin.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/PRI. And Bluevine, offering businesses revolving lines of credit to help them grow and to expand. Credit lines up to $100,000. Small business credit help is available at bluevine.com. You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
In these days where the latest viral jibe regarding the government might end up on Saturday Night Live, it's worth remembering a time when satire and humor with an anarchist level of aggression was not the norm. Not so long ago, in polite conversation, there would typically be just one snarky, clever person who could go on about everything and was a riot to listen to. Chuck Klosterman is that person. His smartest person in the room attitude with a laugh track to go with it has produced 10 books, novels, nonfiction, road narratives, and memoirs. But his latest book, Chuck Klosterman 10, A Highly Specific, Defiantly Incomplete History of the Early 21st Century, is a collection of essays that makes sense of the senselessness in our time and also delivers his informed point of view on sports and music. Kobe Bryant and Jimmy Page are profiled on these pages, among others. If overindulgence in popular culture has a therapist, his name is Chuck Klosterman.
I write about popular culture, you know, and the thing about popular culture is it's not something society needs. It's what society wants. Like, we don't need Beyonce. We want Beyonce. And it's the same with the things I cover in the book itself. I'm not somehow suggesting that this is an essential item. If somebody thinks to themselves, that seems like a crazy thing to be reading, I'm not going to try to persuade them otherwise. But if you enjoy reading about things that are weird and kind of tied into the mediated world and sort of presented the way I present things, then I appreciate your support.
You posit this question, which I've thought about but never really, you know, sat down and tried to analyze, and that is, what is the difference between seeing a live event and seeing a recorded sporting event? Because a lot of people, you know, just DVR their sporting events and they consider them equivalent, but they're not equivalent.
Well, you know, many people do try that, and I think that they have the same sort of response that I do, which it does not feel the same, and it doesn't make any sense because we do that with regular programming all the time. But when we're thinking about live events, whether it's sports, election results coming in, I suppose if you love a show like The Voice or any of those programs, there's something different, which is this sense that in life now there are so few unscripted moments that if something truly transcendent happens in a live event and you're not experiencing it live, you will somehow find out. So if
You will find out because it gets blitzed at you through YouTube.
Well, exactly. And that takes away, I think, some of the excitement of liveness. I mean, this sense that what you're seeing is not what you expect, but somehow beyond that. And when you remove that, starts feeling like a manufactured thing, which it is.
You have this great essay about the band Pavement, which reminds me of the movie High Fidelity and the Jack Black character, who is so absolutely convinced of where each band and every single fits into the philosophical firmament called music. In the time of that book and movie, High Fidelity, Jack Black was kind of a silly, geeky character, but I think actually music does form more of a commentary today, almost.
That's
than
interesting.
It did a long time ago.
Why do you think that?
Because it represents particular groups. It's much more likely to comment on what's going on socially.
See, I would argue that really peaked in the 80s and 90s, and that when the music industry sort of collapsed because of file sharing, you know, the principal thing it did for the consumer is almost move us back to the way things were in the 50s and early 60s, all singles, okay? And because it's now a singles culture, it's very possible that a young person or a young adult purchasing music sort of a la carte will have a collection of music that doesn't really have any kind of thematic relationship. Whereas in the 80s and 90s, where music was really jammed into genres, and if you were the kind of person who, say, bought a Cure record, you're almost saying to yourself, well, I'm entering this subculture or trying to. Now I feel like the thing you're talking about, you know, I mean, High Fidelity as a book came out in the late 90s. I feel like the movie was 99 or 2000. It was already starting to change then. I mean, this is kind of my opinion, but I really feel that there is less of a culture with music than there was, sort of a loss of a constructed culture that for the people existing within it was completely real. You
know? Well, what we've lost is a mass shared culture with the exception of Beyonce. But what we've gained is look at the NBA. I mean, those guys walk onto the gym floor with headphones on. The NFL draft has got a playlist that goes with each draftee walking up onto the stage. Everyone has created a soundtrack to their own music. I mean, the fusion of sports and music, the fusion of, I think sort of lifestyle and music. People are very serious about their music. It's almost as though everyone's become a kind of a low-grade Jack Black.
Well, everyone, I feel, has moved toward the sense that they have more autonomy over what their listening experience is, and they're building it for themselves. And because of that, I think that having sort of unlimited access to all culture shifts our view of what is necessary or important. It all sort of equates to the same shallow ocean of content. You know, I hate when I talk like this because I'm only 45. It makes me sound very old. But I do recall a time when a signifier of intelligence was straight up memory. You know, could you remember, you read a book about the Civil War. What was how well do you remember that in conversation? Do you remember the things that you did not experience? When I was getting into music in the 80s, to be a knowledgeable person, it means you had to know about the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and all of these things to be kind of literate.
Like the Vietnam War, you had to know about that.
Yes. What has changed to me, it seems as though people who grew up native to the internet have somewhat of a adversarial relationship with history, in the sense that they know it's so easy to access and learn about. The idea of being the kind of person who thinks or sort of dwells on the past seems ludicrous. They're only interested sort of in the present moment and what the present moment could be in the future. They're like, I don't need to know about Vietnam. I can find it on my phone.
So the notion of someone who has a sophisticated knowledge of history as a landscape in their brain, a linear kind of construct of this happened, this happened, this happened, and this is where it happened, has become a series of Google search dots.
Sure. I mean, I wrote about this in one of my previous books. You know, I worked at newspapers throughout the 90s, and at every newspaper there was always this person who maybe they weren't so central to the day-to-day operation of the publication, but they were the person you could go up to and be like, hey, you know, I'm trying to write about this. There's this movie. It's from the 70s. It's about cars, and there's some musicians in it, and I feel like there's a scene where, like, the film burns up, and the guy would go, oh, that's Tulane Blacktop. And you'd be like, yes, that's what I was thinking of. Well, the necessity of that person is gone. The idea of the person who sort of collects the minutiae of the popular culture and stores it in their mind in a imperfect way, but can sort of be jarred to remember something. There's no need for that now. But as always, you know, the world changes and it doesn't really get better or worse. It just gets different. But if you're used to something, it's going to seem worse because it's going to seem discomforting. And I try to stay conscious of that as I sort of see the evolution of these things and I'm bothered by them, I always realize that what I'm not really bothered by is the content, but I'm bothered by the fact that it's new content to me.
Chuck Klosterman, it's great talking to you.
I appreciate you having me on.
Chuck Klosterman is the author of 10 books. His latest out this week, it's called Chuck Klosterman 10, A Highly Specific, Defiantly Incomplete History of the Early 21st Century. As always, and especially when there's so much news these days, we want to hear from you. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.